This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with an airport director about a runway rehabilitation project. There's a lot more to closing down the primary runway for a project like this than you might imagine. In the news, airports challenged by drone threats, handling emergency airline landings, some Boeing 737 MAX charges are dropped, and North Atlantic tracks below flight level 330 are dropped. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 691 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me first is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian from the American Helicopter Museum.
Hello, everyone. Looks like we're talking about the Great White North this evening. It doesn't get much more north in the continental U.S. than this airport. Pretty cool.
Speaking about pretty cool, we also have with us Rob Mark. He's our contributing editor to Business and Commercial Aviation, part of the Aviation Week group, and he's also a publisher at jetwine.com.
Hey, good evening. And you're saying that I'm in the cool bunch?
Well, you know, I figured we'll throw you a bone once.
Yeah, okay. Should be fun tonight.
Yes. And to help with the fun, with the jocularity, we have our main man, Micah, joining us this episode. Hey, Micah.
Hey, everybody. So nice to be able to come along for the ride. And it's always wonderful when Rob and I can hang out together. Usually they make us sit in opposite corners.
For good reason. Max Trescott is off this week. Hopefully he'll be joining us again next week. And it's time to introduce our guest for this episode. It's Paul Bradbury. He's airport director for the Portland International Jetport, PWM. Paul, you've been airport director since 2008, I guess, the same year that we started Airplane Geeks.
Wow. Isn't that a coincidence? That's impressive.
And of course, Paul's responsible for the overall management of the airport operations and planning. You're also a licensed professional engineer, have a BS in engineering from Rensselaer Polytech Institute. How'd you like RPI? I applied to RPI. That was one of the colleges I applied to.
I enjoyed RPI, and it was close to Vermont. You could get some good skiing in this time of year, so that's always great. And there's a lot of other great universities nearby too. So we weren't want for trips north to Schenectady and Rochester.
That's great. Yeah, I wasn't too far away from you, more or less in Ithaca. So pretty close. Well, Paul has been thinking about more than a little bit some major airport maintenance. Would you call this maintenance of the runways?
Yeah, I think that's fair. We don't generally call it maintenance. It is a capital program, unlike your normal annual crack sealing and those kind of maintenance for an airfield surface. So I would call it more. So it's a full rehabilitation of our runway, but it's one short of a full reconstruction, right? So it's a complete mill and overlay. But most importantly, it means you're without your primary runway for 8 weeks. So it's a significant project and many years in the planning.
Well, we're going to talk about that challenge coming up and learn how an airport goes about something as major a project as this. But first, we have some aviation news from the past week. Is everyone ready?
Ready.
I'm mainly ready.
First item comes from TSI Mag. This is airports face legal policy hurdles encountering chronic drone threat. Now, we've seen airports around the world have been plagued by drone incursions into the airspace. But as this article points out, actions that an airport can take are very limited. There's some really useful information about this in a report that was issued last September 2021. By the National Safe Skies Alliance. It's a nonprofit. They're FAA-funded. And their report is titled Airport Response to Unmanned Aircraft System Threats. Now, you may or may not know, but there is a lot of both active and passive counter drone technology that's out there, but it's not really out there in the sense that in the United States, there are only four federal agencies that can use them: the Departments of Defense, Energy, Homeland Security, and Justice. They can mitigate a drone threat in certain circumstances, but others can't, even to the point of not being able to even intercept or jam the signals, because that runs afoul of some other laws and restrictions. So with all that, what is an airport to do? And so this is a question for Paul. First of all, have you experienced drone incursions at the jetport?
Thankfully, we have not had a drone incursion. We did find one close to the airport, but there was no report of it, and it was down on the ground. And it was actually inside the fence, but a very small one. But I think we all remember before the pandemic, Newark, its airspace was shut down for a period of time, just a short period. But it was really Gatwick, right, that put the world on its head again a few years ago now, but down for days. And it was a recurring drone issue. And that's what really made us all in this country start to say, wow, what do we need to do to make sure we have some tools in the toolbox? And what's really interesting, as you already noted, Max, in the intro, is that in the U.S., we treat drones like any other aviation, and it's completely illegal to have any impact on an aircraft in flight, and these are still considered aircraft, and you could actually be charged.
That's right. And do you have a protocol at the airport set up so that if an event like this were to occur, that you have a process for handling that?
Well, interesting that you should say all Part 139 airports have what's called an airport certification manual. And we are now, it's just now over the next, in this year, the airports are now required to start putting together, similar to your airport emergency plan, an action or response plan for UAS. But it is not yet required, but we will have to have it in place by our next 139 inspection.
Do airports collaborate on these kinds of issues? Are you an island in and of yourself trying to figure this out, or do you collaborate with other airports or the trade organization?
Absolutely. I mean, Logan sponsors twice a year a runway safety action. It's a runway safety summit, basically, that airports all throughout New England attend. And one of the spotlight elements, as you know, was UAS. And discussing options and being prepared for that. And some states have done a lot more work than others in terms of evaluating and looking at the mitigation methods. But to your point, airports are still not allowed to interfere with a UAS in flight. It has to be the departments of the federal government if you're trying to knock it out of the sky, so to speak.
I think that's probably something that a lot of the public doesn't understand. I mean, they probably assume that if someone flies a drone over an airport into the airspace there, that the airport or the authorities, the police or somebody could take some specific action to bring that thing down or something of that sort, but it's not the case. The article does point out that the first line of response is supposed to be, at this point, state and local police agencies, but they may or may not be able to be of much help. Another item that's mentioned in the article is we have this concept of remote ID. This is something new where drones above a certain size would be required to broadcast identifying information in the clear. And it's thought that, but maybe that would help in this situation, being able to identify perhaps who's operating a rogue drone. Implementation of that is slated for September this year. But as David knows, the rule is being challenged in court. So we don't know if we're going to actually see this come to pass in September or not. All right, moving on. From Travel Pulse, is this the worst airline passenger of 2022 so far? Rob, you know, every day, it seems, on the news, we see more and more examples of the kind of behavior on flights that we really don't want to see.
Well, you know, it's funny because I was thinking as we were talking about drones, drones were the big news item a few years ago. And then unruly passengers seem to kind of overtake that whole topic. And now all we hear about are weird airline passengers. And I just put this one up here because it was so strange. This guy in the back of a, let's see, did it say what kind of an airline? I think he was on Frontier.
He was on Frontier.
Yeah. And so I've got a friend that's a captain at Frontier. So I always call him and go, was this your guy? You know, was this on your flight? And he says, no. But the guy was yelling about the lady behind him sticking needles through his seat to extract his DNA. And so they managed to tie this guy down. And I think what it proves is that you don't need a COVID card to get on an airliner. You need a mental competency check, I think, before you get on an airliner.
Well, you know what the problem was, Rob? The specific problem was that TSA, when he was boarding, took away his tinfoil hat, so it wasn't able to really help himself.
Yeah, that's probably true. And I've been very lucky over the years that I've never managed to sit next to one of these tinfoil guys or ladies. I can't imagine people that fly often, but then let's consider that, you know, Frontier is an ultra low-cost carrier, which means I think they pay the passenger to get on the airplane or something. I don't remember, but when you have the cheapest flights possible, there's always going to be somebody that gets on for $69 and is a little whacked out. And this guy just took the cake.
There is good news about this, Rob. There's very good news, you know, because Frontier now is merging, if it's allowed, with Spirit. So they're now going to be the number five size carrier. But even though they'll be number five, they will still be number one in bad service.
And we wondered if the new Frontier people will have the Spirit once they get going as a merged airline. But okay.
Well, we've talked in the past about the role of the cabin crew, flight attendants in a situation like this and what they're often called upon to deal with. The video in this case shows six other passengers piled up on top of this this gentleman to restrain him. So the passengers acted, and I think as you mentioned, Rob, they tied him down to his seat. When the plane arrived at Raleigh-Durham International Airport, the local police were waiting for him. So it involved a diversion, so that's an inconvenience to the other passengers. And then when it landed, it was 2 hours longer, 2 hours additional before the flight resumed. So, I mean, this has a big impact on the rest of the passengers, not to mention the impact on the airline.
Paul, do you get a lot of these diverted flights with unusual people in rubber suits? I'm sorry, I shouldn't say that. That's very disparaging to people that are, and I... Okay, I'm just
going to get yourself in trouble. Deeper.
You're right. One thing you don't know, Paul, is my wife's a shrink. So I'm always asking her if I'm crazy, and she's that's a given. I mean, I've been told many times that I was her research project, and so for almost 30 years. The research has been ongoing, and I'm beginning to get the impression it's not going well.
Inconclusive, huh?
Yeah, I think it is. But no, seriously, these people are really scary. Can you imagine the poor person, and it looked like that flight was pretty full, that even when they restrained this guy, maybe in a window seat, that you were the person in the middle seat next to him? And what do you do? You just kind of, you know, you sit there and...
Try to not get involved, or
well, yeah, and the guys, did you see what they did with my DNA? And, you know, you're just going, oh, my God. I mean, I don't know. It's really scary.
So, Paul, when a flight is, you know, redirected in this way, has to make an emergency landing, how does the airport get involved in that process?
So, I mean, there's – and at first I should start that the pandemic has really, really changed the number of instances where we have this in-flight ridiculous behavior by our passengers. I'm not sure what has happened. I mean, I think we all remember not that long ago the poor Southwest flight attendant who lost a tooth when a passenger decided they should strike the flight attendant in the face. And we all know the FAA has really worked hard to bring this back. They've been fining, but we've never seen anything like this in aviation. So it's a very, very strange time. And I'm just going to come right out there and blame it on the pandemic. I just think it's the extension of the pandemic. But yes, in terms of airports, usually they'll divert if it's coming overseas, and they'll divert to Bangor, big runway. And if there's a diversion coming this way, often the divert will be to Boston, just because they're more likely to have that airline represented there. But we will get diversions, and when this type of thing happens, our law enforcement has to meet them right at the plane, and the individual is removed. More often than not, when we get them, though, it was somebody that was misbehaving, but they were already scheduled to arrive here. We didn't just send them back, although that would have probably been preferred.
Yeah, hopefully this is not a trend that's with us now forever, but we'll see. Our next item comes from PCDN.co. We had talked previously about the former Boeing 737 MAX chief technical pilot and how he had been charged with, I think, six counts in total. But what's happened here now is that the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Texas Fort Worth Division has dismissed two of the counts against the former Boeing chief technical pilot, Mark Faulkner. And it sort of seems like a technicality in a way. In these counts, Faulkner was alleged to have, quote, knowingly and with the intent to defraud, made and used a materially false writing, entry, certification, document, record, data plate, label, and electronic communication concerning an aircraft part. Now, the last piece is the key, aircraft part. So the judge wrote in this case that because MCAS is not an aircraft part, as defined in 18 U.S.C. paragraph 31A7, the indictment fails to allege an offense that defendant violated that or paragraph 38A1C. So in other words, those two counts were dropped because MCAS software is not considered a part. Now, Faulkner still has the remaining counts, which I think is four counts on wire fraud and some things like that. But those two counts were dropped. So that's kind of an interesting development.
Do you know that whole story? I mean, if you look at those indictments, they didn't honestly say that he did something. He's kind of indirectly tied to some of these charges, even the wire fraud one. They're not saying that he personally, you know, initiated some wire frauds that were illegal. I don't know. I still think that when we go back to the initial time that we mentioned this, nobody was really sure if Boeing was making a scapegoat out of this guy or what. And again, we still don't know, but I don't think there's much of a story around this that is new.
He's still going to trial. In fact, that's supposed to start next month in March. And so, we'll see what happens there. It depends on the evidence, obviously. It's, you know, what are the charges? What is the evidence? And what laws were broken? And, you know, the judge and the jury will end up letting us know the answer to those questions. But this is a...
I think...
Yeah,
Max,
go ahead, Micah.
The part of this comes down to... he may or may not have had some responsibility in this, but is this something that he was required to do as part of his job? And was it a culture of Boeing? Can you, it was going on from higher ups within Boeing and the whole Boeing Corporation, is, as Rob said, a scapegoat that's being pointed to, because we can see that he did something as part of this, but it really had nothing to do with him as much as it did with the whole corporation, which obviously has some problems that we've discussed with a number of authors and have discussed over and over among ourselves. So I think there's a lot to be said for this, and I'm not sure that he's not guilty, but I'm not sure if he's guilty either.
Yeah, one thing to note is that he's on trial here. Boeing is not on trial in this particular case. So if like you say, the culture or there's some other impacts of the corporation, of Boeing, you know, on this guy that, you know, contributed to this. I don't know how that'll play out. My approach to this is that even if an individual in a company misbehaves, it's ultimately the responsibility of the company, to me. And if they have an employee that's doing things improper, well, that company should have the processes in place to manage that, to identify situations and manage that. So in my mind,
and clearly Boeing didn't.
And clearly they didn't. So that's the update on this case. If the trial does start, I guess within a few weeks, we ought to be hearing more about that. I don't know if this is one of those trials that's going to go on for weeks and months, or if this is going to be something that's relatively quick, but I guess we'll find out pretty soon. All right. This is another. This is an interesting piece, an interesting article. This is from Simple Flying. Why are North Atlantic tracks below flight level 330 being scrapped? Now we have this this thing called the North Atlantic Organized Track System, which is popularly called the North Atlantic Tracks. Micah, are you familiar with these tracks across the Atlantic?
Only because I like to watch my ADS-B and Flight Radar 24, and every so often at 2 o'clock in the morning, I'll enlarge it shrink it down rather, and see what's going on. And you can see it's highways in the sky, and everybody's flying the same route, one behind the other, and it's really a beautiful thing to see. I happen to like that app, and pretty fun to watch. And I thought this article was fascinating that they're. Because of the new satellite ADS-B that they are putting into place, they're going to be able to get rid of the tracks, which is going to benefit fuel economy and some more direct routes.
So these tracks are created daily. They're not fixed. They're not static. The actual tracks depend on the jet stream and, you know, other weather conditions, I guess. And so they're created each day. And so as you mentioned, Micah, the Ariane satellite-based ADS-B system allows much more frequent updates of aircraft location. So the current system, the old system, under that, locations were updated about every 14 minutes. But with this satellite-based system, aircraft location can be updated every 7 or 8 seconds, so you know where aircraft are. So, Rob, I kind of get the impression that they're, you know, walking before they run with this, and that's maybe why they're starting with flights below 33,000 feet. There's certainly tracks above that, but I think they're kind of testing this out at that level.
I think they were waiting for an opportunity. I mean, the tracks are pretty old technology. I mean, they're based on distance and time, which is the way they used to work traffic across the Atlantic. That if Speedbird 507 crossed 30 west at 2037 UTC, then another airplane, needed to cross the same point at the same altitude. I think it's maybe 10 minutes behind him or something like that. And that's how they assured that they had the lateral separation that they needed. But it's pretty old, and it's not very efficient. And everybody's been looking for an opportunity. And the pandemic kind of gave the folks at NATS, you know, a chance to test this. And so in cooperation with the NAV Canada folks, they said, hey, let's go for it. And it's pretty cool because, as Micah said, it's going to not simply save time, but think of time in terms of fuel burn. And if you can knock 5 minutes off of an airline flight times 500 flights a day times 7 days a week times, you know, 4 weeks per month, I mean, you're talking about some serious reductions in emissions. So, again, that's really part of the goal. Plus, I think it helps the controllers by them not having to listen to pilots say, well, can't we just go direct, please? Our technology will allow us. And they go, yeah, but ours won't. They've been saying that for years. So I think the controllers are going to be a little happy with this too.
Hey, did I say that you know, under the previous system that locations were updated every 14 minutes? Because I meant to say 14 seconds, and I'm not sure if I well, I'm not sure which I said.
You said 14 minutes, yeah.
Good, good. I caught myself. So it's 14 seconds. So it's basically updates twice as frequently, and that affects the aircraft separation.
What the article continues to say is that the pandemic, this is actually something we can be thankful to the pandemic for in terms of trying, because while there were on average, they said, quoted it as 1,700 flight movements a day, it's down to 200 with the pandemic going across the Atlantic. So that's not great for the airlines, but it does allow them to test it because there are far fewer aircraft they have to be concerned about and be watching.
Yeah, and the track across the North Atlantic that North Atlantic airspace is the busiest airspace in the world normally. Hmm. So it means quite a bit if they can get this right.
Again, we're speaking with Paul Bradbury, Airport Director at Portland International Jetport.
I just wanted to say on that earlier discussion, Mike has probably done it. If you just go trout fishing in a northern Maine lake, You will see that corridor is the busiest because all of those tracks come right over northern Maine. It's the Great Circle, right? Yeah. So any of those northern lakes in Maine, if you just look up by noontime, you'll have seen many of those jets coming across to New York, to Chicago, to L.A. They're all coming right across the top. And it's a beautiful thing to see.
Popular airspace. So, Paul, describe for us, kind of maybe in some detail, just exactly what the work is that is going to be taking place at the airport. And then we can talk about how that gets planned and managed and all of that. But let's start out talking about just physically what's going to happen.
Sure. Our primary runway, runway 1129, which is our east-west runway, obviously, to this group knows that. It's a complete rehabilitation, meaning we'll take the top pavement off and we'll put new pavement on. And what does that mean? You think, well, it doesn't sound like much, but it's actually, and if you check our website, it's 34,000 tons of asphalt. I mean, you think, whoa, 7,200 foot runway? That can't be. No, again, it's 34,000 tons of asphalt need to be put down, and it's 27 and a half acres of pavement. So in Portland, it is a grooved asphalt runway. So asphalt as opposed to concrete, right? Those are your two, and there's pros and cons to each. But so how frequently do we do a project like this? You know, you want to hold them off as long as possible. And, you know, so this is I was here for the last one, which we did in 2004. So you can run the numbers, 18 years. It'll be just about 18 years by the time we start. And that's right in what you'd think of as the sweet spot for a runway rehabilitation. It's 15 to 20 is what you get. The FAA part of the timing is also based on FAA funding, right? So a rehabilitation, it's more than 10 years. A full reconstruction is over 20. We can delve in as deep as you want. I do geek out myself sometimes on and engineering and construction. So, but a full reconstruction is you get down to the base materials as well. We're just taking off those top 6 or so inches of, and it depends on the location. It varies as you come across the runway because you have to make sure things drain. The last thing we want is ponding on a runway, right? So we're also doing lighting. So 19.7 miles of wire, new cans, more are getting LED upgrades to the lighting system on the centerline lighting. So a lot of really interesting things going on as part of this project. And it does, when you look at this window, it does impact over 5,000 flights. So so it's significant, the big time for 8 weeks of work here.
So how do you know when it's time to do something like this? Are there inspections by the FAA, or is it just time-based? When do you know that now is the time to do this?
That's a great question. And every airport, every 139 airport, has to have a pavement management plan. So we do have a pavement management plan, and part of that is it gives a condition assessment, which in the industry, it's Pavement Condition Index. People may have heard of PCI. And based on that level, you can have a PCI of excellent, good, fair, and poor, right? At airports, as you start to get into that fair and moving towards poor, we are still obligated to have a safe airfield. So what really ends up happening is your actual maintenance costs will start to go up as well. And then you're doing patching and more crack sealing and all of those type of things that are just right out the door maintenance that and when you start to see those maintenance costs rising, you don't need the PCI, right? You can just know from the amount you're spending every year on just maintaining that surface to keep it free of foreign object and debris and those type of issues. And again, if we looked at a concrete runway, those are a much longer life, from 30 to 50 years. So, but then the question is, well, why would you do asphalt then? So, you know, there are pros and cons. Concrete's more expensive, but it also takes a lot longer to install. So we'd have a much longer shutdown if our runway was concrete. And concrete is also can be trickier in northern climates with all the, you know, they don't tend to last as long.
Yeah, the freeze-thaw cycle.
Yeah.
Is the asphalt that they skim off the top, is that recyclable?
It absolutely is. And it's so on that milling operation where you actually grind that surface off, that material can all go back and it can be used to build other roads. It can be used as aggregate fill. So absolutely, it will not be wasted because it is a great compactable backfill material. And it can be returned to asphalt as well. It can be mixed in and you can make new asphalt from it. But it would likely not be a grade or spec that would match for a runway, the FAA specification for runway use. But for many other roads, it works just fine. It can be blended back in.
So based on what you said, in terms of it needing to be done every 10 years to resurface and then 20 years to replace the runway, does that mean that basically we can look forward to doing this again but replacing the runway another decade from now, more or less?
So no. What will happen with us is, yeah, you'd be eligible to do another mill and overlay in as little as 10 years. But really, we wouldn't do – if you can keep and rehabilitate your runway frequently enough and not let it go too far – then you don't have to reconstruct. You could just keep doing rehabilitations every 15 to 20 years and be fine. But there are points where you do a full reconstruction for those other systems like lighting as well. But in general, a reconstruction also increases the strength of the runway, meaning we go down with a deeper cut and replace more of the runway buildup. And we think of that top, you know, 6 to 10 inches of asphalt as the runway, but it's feet of gradated gravel, right, that builds a roadbed or, in this case, a runway. And when you start to look at aircraft now at 600,000 pounds, you need a really good structure, better than most roadways, right? So you don't want to let it go. But great question.
You know, Paul, we've been asking our listeners lately to submit any questions they might have for the guests that we have coming up. And my 89-year-old mother caught wind of that. And so she fed me a whole lot of questions for you. One of them we can slip in here because it's kind of fits with what you were describing. And she wanted to know if runway materials have changed over the years. Are we still using the same stuff we've always used, or is it getting better?
You know, what's really interesting is it hasn't changed all that much. Roads and the kind of materials we use really hasn't. And it's a bit surprising, right? Because how much has changed everywhere else in aviation, right? But when it comes to asphalt and aggregate and concrete, we've learned a little bit. You know, with concrete, people may remember that there was this thing called ASR, alkali silica reaction, which causes concretes and runways to grow. And it was just a chemistry that came up when they, you know, and it really was in the 90s, the early 90s. You'd think we'd been using concrete since the Romans, since the dawn of the Roman Empire. You'd think we'd have it licked. But no, we decided we'd messed with the chemistry. And next thing we know, we have runways and aprons growing that are made from concrete. And when they grow, they bust, right? If you can't control that, where they get to the edges. So very interesting. So a lot of, and actually one of our aprons, our FedEx apron has ASR. And I know Bangor in Northern Maine has had some issues with ASR. But generally, no, there isn't a lot of change, which is shockingly, it's surprising because, again, we look at even like an A320neo and its fuel burn and how quiet they are with these new engines. You know, Neo sounds so neat, but it's just new engine option. But it does sound like it should be something even more cool than just new engine option. But but yeah, it's so much quieter and so much more fuel efficient. So many things have changed. But no, roads and runways and how we build them hasn't changed significantly over the past 50 years.
This is probably a really stupid question spoken from someone who is not an engineer. But I watched them do complete reconstruction on the airport here at Chicago Executive a few years ago. They went down to the nothingness, you know, to where you thought China was coming next. But what I've always thought was interesting is when they lay the new surface out, how do they maintain the consistency of it all being level? I mean, I can see how you sit on one end and, I mean, I've watched them pour concrete sidewalks and, I mean, they use a 2x4 and, you know, and it, they go, yeah, it's okay. It's a great, but over those distances, how do you make sure that you don't have dips and rises in the surface as it settles?
Great question. And on that front, there has been a lot of technology that has changed, right?
Ah.
I mean, yeah, so a huge technology on that side of construction. I mean, now, so you're setting grade. I mean, and we used to do it, right? You'd set grade stakes, literally. And then you have somebody with a transit, and they put a little mark on the grade stake, and then you grade to the mark on the grade stake, and you'll put the grade stakes every 25 feet, and they're running that as their level line. Now the same bulldozer doesn't need a grade stake because it's got a GPS that's articulating the blade to make sure that you're running true.
Wow.
But keeping in mind that the runways are essentially linear, but they aren't level, right? I mean, there's a 30-foot elevation difference roughly on ours from one end to the other. But right, you can't have any dips but you can have them, you know, they can go up or downhill. You don't want it to, it can't be too much. Your slope can't exceed what aircraft manufacturers dime, but they do have grades. There are grades on runways, but there are no dips or rises that are steep, right? To your point.
Well, they're usually just a little higher in the center than they are on the edges, isn't it? So the water will run off.
So that's the runway camber. And that is exactly right. And we call that the cross slope of the runway. And you still want to match in, when you do a new project, you still have to match into all the taxiways that are mixing in too.
Oh, right.
The biggest thing, like I said, you can't have standing water, right? So the runway surface, after we get this all paved, we'll also groove it. Another big machine comes that cuts these transverse grooves down the longitudinal length of the runway. And that makes sure that any water that might form, you know, any dip that might form over time still has a drainage to keep it from being a standing puddle that could have, you know, hydroplane possibility. So exactly right. There's a crown on the center that is that then comes off to the edges because it just sheet flows, and it will sheet flow via the those cut, you know, surface on the surface of the runway, that grooving that I talked about.
Paul, who's qualified to do this kind of construction work? I mean, is it the same companies that are out there surfacing Route 1, or are these specialists?
That's another great question. So actually, it is the same crews. Ours is a 13.8 million dollar project, and it will be round the clock, right? Because the lifeblood of an airport is its primary runway, and you have to minimize the time out there. And we had three bids. They're all contractors we'd worked with in the past, but the winner here was one of the larger paving contractors in the state. Became the GC for the overall project. And you'll say, well, why is that? They also have their own paving plants. And these paving plants for this 8 weeks project have to generate that 34,000 tons of asphalt bituminous paving. And so there's not that many contractors, right? So you need a paving plant, and you need it relatively close to the airport. So there's no entity other than the same ones that do the roads, but it is a different mix design. It has bigger aggregate, and it's a stiffer mix, what we call. It's a little harder to place, actually.
With all the drainage going on, I'm assuming there must be, and I never really thought of this before, but some kind of grates and drainage system, like a sewage, not sewage, but that kind of system under those runways, and that takes that runoff and moves it someplace. It must be an incredible system that's been there forever that we've never really thought about. Is that going to be the same, or do you need to replace that as well?
So that, in this case, is the same because all those grates, they aren't in the runway. Again, as Rob was saying, it sheet flows off based on that crown and camber to the edges of the runway. And then in our safety areas, that's where we have the stormwater drains, and all those grates that you mentioned are in the safety. So we take the water, it comes off the runway, that 150 feet, and then off the edge and then goes into those edges. Then we have the drainage in the snow shoulders and in the safety areas, in the grass safety areas. And it is to your point, it's a big system with lots of large pipe from as small as 14-inch up to 36-inch storm drain pipes. And in our case, these then drain to the edge of the airport. We do have detention, you know, just to get any materials out, you know, with all of the kind of a little bit of pretreatment, and then it goes into the bay here. And I should say that one area that the technology has changed, Max, I don't want to give misinformation, but there is one area, and that's the lighting systems, right? I did mention briefly LEDs, so significant reduction in wattage, brighter. The base is still the same in that these are more like your Christmas tree. They're all wired in series, and they're constant current, not constant voltage. Again, I'm geeking out a little bit. Your home is a constant voltage, but runway lighting systems are actually constant current. And why is that? Because the voltage can spike because you're going such long distances. We want to keep that voltage high, 3,000 volts, but then we regulate each light by its current, and everything is wired actually in series, not in parallel. And that saves on the amount of cable and it saves on the size of cable. But LED just has taken that to the next level.
So if one runway light goes out, they all go out?
No, but that's how your Christmas tree works. But it's a slightly more sophisticated. So at each
Goodness. Yeah. I mean, every year, my gosh, I must buy 6 or 8 new sets of lighting. Okay, I'm
sorry.
Well,
you said series, and I'm thinking back to, 10th grade physical science.
Yeah, exactly.
So they do, they won't go out because at each light there is a smaller regulator on that constant current. So the light will go out, but it still feeds through to all the other lights.
Okay, good.
When I first heard about this project, and if Rob can ask a silly question for not being an engineer, I'm going to ask a silly question for not being an engineer nor a pilot, but 1129, the east-west runway, because our winds are predominantly east-west, and then there's 1836, which is obviously you can't get more north and south than that. But 1129, the one that we're closing down, that's, if I remember correctly, 7,200 feet. And 1836 is 6,100 feet in a crosswind. We have, I think our largest aircraft we have coming in are the FedEx 757 and A300. And how were you able to, I mean, we've got a lot of big planes coming through. How were you able to plan that so they could land on that short runway sometimes in a big crosswind?
So, Micah, it's an excellent question. And there will be, we could have, or likely will have more cancellations. If we get into some really strong winds that are east-west, the crosswind component could be too high and we could have some cancellations. That is another whole reason why we're looking to have this as a 56-day project, right? Is that we don't have our ILS. So, the north-south runway is a GPS, right, approaches and not the ILS. So if we have a dense fog, we're also going to take, unfortunately, significant cancellations if that occurs. But in general, what's really interesting to me, we are at sea level. It is we're doing this as early. The problem with Maine, right, is our construction season isn't long. So we backed this up. When we looked at the schedule, we said, summer is our busiest, right? So after Memorial Day, that's when we have our most flights, the most passengers. So we had to look really how the best time to do this would be January. But that doesn't work.
Yeah.
January is our slowest month. So the tightest we could go is this April, is the April's timeline that we did. We actually can still get snow April 15th. And here we are, we're doing our startup on April 18th. Some of that milling can be done. So literally, we have pushed this as tight as we could to that early season. And where I was going here is it's not hot, right? So you won't have that issue with your weight and balance, meaning you won't have a 100-degree day that, the air is really thin, it's really hot. So that helps us. But we could have one of those foggy days as we get later in this project, and that could be a problem. So you are absolutely right, and you do the best you can. Is what's going to happen. But it is, I can just tell you, Micah, one of our city councilors, our District 3 city councilor, Councilor Chong, is the chair of our noise advisory committee, and his house is immediately north of the airport. And when that A300 or the 747 goes over, it literally on landing, it's only about 325 feet over his house when we're departing or arriving from the north.
Oh, so there must have been a lot of communication with the public as well as with the those who would be flying in.
In the communication continues. We're actually, you noted that we have the website up and running. So that's a special splash page just for this project that we've pushed to all of our neighbors. But we're also doing some decidedly low tech. We're doing direct mailers as well. Because the worst thing, I think we all know, the worst thing is when something comes up and you had no idea. Suddenly these airplanes, what is going on? And your head explodes. So we're hoping to get out early and often, and we've already done a media outreach, and we've already done several press releases, and then we will be doing direct mailers to all homes within 5 miles of each of the north-south approach, north-south runways approaches and departures. And we're also working on some new modified procedures to try to get them to altitude faster on the departures. So ATC is still working on those, so we haven't rolled them out, but we will be getting those as part of the mailer as well. So a lot of interesting work on that front.
Are you having extra people? Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, I'm a mile off of 1-8, and today I happen to catch an American A319 coming in at about 500 feet in that direction. I said, okay, somebody's practicing, which was great from my perspective. But I must apologize. I planned on attending the Zoom Noise Advisory Committee meeting because I wanted to speak out in favor of the project and be there for you, and I missed it, and I apologize for that. But I'm wondering how that went and what has been the reaction so far.
So I think in general, they do recognize that this is a once in 15 to 20 year thing. And part of what made it more palatable to the region, and we worked this through, but there's 29 nights that we have to do a full closure. So that is really from 10:30 PM to 5:45 AM. It's really unfortunate for us, you know, for operations, but we've rolled it out and we put it to our airline partners. We could have done a 48-hour complete closure of the airport or a 29-night closure of both runways from 10:30 P to 5:45 A. And the airlines, at least what we call a majority in interest, chose the more, because just to be perfectly honest, that impacted fewer flights than it seems funny that 29 nights is less impactful than just 48 total hours, but it is. And that's what they chose. But it wasn't, I thought they would choose the 29 nights by a wide majority, but it was not. It was probably 60%. But it was overwhelmingly, obviously, supported by our neighbors.
Yes.
I was very surprised by that because, you don't have to respond to specific airlines, but FedEx always come. They're flying in and out at those times regularly with the larger aircraft, and Delta has a regular flight that comes in daily, usually at about 11:30 from Atlanta. United has a regular flight from Newark that comes in at about 11 o'clock. So it's very impactful. It surprised me that they went that way. I assumed that they would go for. It would be easier to go 48 hours and say, okay, for 2 days. We're not going to have any flights. It's a shocker to hear that was a decision.
So I can say the 40% that didn't want it, I think they had the because there were a couple that the 48 hours had less impact. But it was interesting. And in what the with the 48-hour closure, though, here's the other problem, is that you can't just change your schedule. You literally have to cancel all your flights for 48 hours. Whereas for the 29 nights, you can shift flights. It's not ideal, but network planning can make it happen. And the other part is we aren't complete by the end, Memorial Day. That's kind of the for our tourism and hospitality, that's the start of Maine's tourism season. And they were really nervous about the timing of that. So the fact that we could get everything back up and running by June, have the 29 days end early in June on June 13th, they were pretty comfortable that was the best plan for them. But we'll see. I mean,
And broadly speaking, I mean, this is something that's not unique to the airlines and the others, right? I mean, every airport they fly to is going to have this to some degree, this issue at some point in time. But it does sound like it's a massive project with a lot of pieces fitting together that have to work. Who does the overall project planning here? Is that something that you do, or is that something that the general contractor does?
It's definitely a team effort, as you would guess. So we have our design team, which our lead design is a company, is an A&E firm called Stantec, who consults for many airports across the country. They're a large architectural engineering firm. But we have, for instance, on our team, we have a safety manager who is doing a full safety management system analysis of the project, which is really, and he's been with us, relatively new to ours, but he's a former pilot and does a great analysis and has been doing air carrier SMS for years now. So that was great. We also have the contractor does reviews as well. There's no question that the contractor is a part of it. But our own operations team is intimate in that as well. So they evaluate the haul routes, all of the means of access to the airfield to make sure that it works best for operations, that it mitigates any opportunity for FOD to contaminate another section of the airport. And for some listeners that are relatively new, I'm sure you hit about foreign object and debris, right? Which is a sin at airports. It makes an airport construction site when you're moving the sheer volume of materials we're talking, it is just unbelievable the opportunities to create FOD, right? So really critical. So it is definitely a team effort across the board on how this gets done. And I can say that our airline partners, just to mention that, we actually had originally planned for this project to be a year ago, but we had to do another whole round of the airlines didn't get it into their network planning early enough. And we're here to work with our airline partners. So we actually held the project off for another year just to make sure we could best optimize their schedule. So you really have to work through all these things and it all. And again, when things seem too tight, it is best to just hold off and make sure that a project like this, that all of your stakeholders are 100% committed to the schedule.
And how is a project like this funded?
So the lion's share of this project is funded with a program. It's called the Airport Improvement Program, which I know everyone on that's here tonight is familiar. But that is the FAA, it's the Federal Aviation Administration's Airport Improvement Program. And where does that money come from? So many have heard this, but when you get on a commercial flight, that ticket is taxed and the fuel that goes into the airplane is taxed. So much like when you fill your vehicle with fuel, that fuel that you put into your car or truck is taxed. And that's how we fund roads in this country. Similar for airports. And that same fund from those taxes is what funds the Aviation Trust Fund, we call it, which also funds the Federal Aviation Administration. So all those taxes, short of the pandemic, which changed things a bit here in the infrastructure bill and in some of these federal bills that have helped during the pandemic, AIP is a trust fund and it's user fee funded.
As a result of that, is there a mechanism that seeks to ensure that value is being received for the federal funds spent?
So, again, with the FAA wants to see, you have to do your master plan and then you have to keep up your airport layout plan and your exhibit, what we call the Exhibit A. All of those, we are continuously letting the FAA know what our upcoming projects are with a 5 and 10 year CIP, because they're trying, obviously there isn't enough money to have multiple airports doing runway rehabilitations and runway reconstructions all at the same time. So the FAA is working to stagger and make sure that all the projects in a particular region are happening in a planned and methodical method so that Logan, Portland, Portsmouth, Pease aren't all doing their runway reconstructions or rehabilitations the same year, right? So they are working because this will take what we call a portion of AIP discretionary. Our normal entitlement is roughly $4.8 million. This is a almost $0.8 million project. And so FAAIP is 90%. Then the airport pays 5% and the state makes up the last 5%. So that's the full funding mechanism.
I don't know, Paul, if I was in your shoes, I'd probably wake up, you know, in the middle of the night often thinking about this whole project. And, you know, is there something that hadn't thought of yet or something that's supposed to happen that's not going to? But I'm sure it'll go smoothly. Sounds like...
I certainly hope so, but I hope a paving plant, there's no issue at the paving plant, right? I mean, but yes, all of the things, what is that Murphy's Law, right? We're hoping that we've figured out what can go wrong and we've got it under control.
Well, there's also Cheops' Law of the Great Pyramid. Nothing gets done on time or under budget.
Yeah, that's true. Micah, does the jet part have a de-icing fluid program? Is that something that... that you're familiar with?
There's a de-icing recycling program. I think it's one of the first in the country. And don't we sell de-icing fluid to DFW, if I remember correctly?
It's actually Dulles. So we sell it back to Dulles, and we've sold to McGuire Air Force Base. We've moved some to it's many. We're selling to airports along the eastern seaboard, I should say, but mostly north of D.C., but yeah, I mean, so we're also taking their effluent. So we take spent ADF and we reprocess it, and then we can sell it back to them. So it works really well. Right now, we don't do all types. You know, we just do the type 2. But yeah, it really is incredible, and it's all from captured, you know, de-icing fluid effluent. And originally, we were just selling back as a propylene glycol commodity. But now we are and remain the only airport in the country with that can sell it as an FAA-approved ADF.
So obviously, you can't let that stuff run into the environment. You have to collect it, right? So I assume, does this work for you because that? You know, at the jet port there up in Maine, you guys are using a lot of this de-icing fluid anyway, so you have a lot to capture.
No, that's exactly right. And so it hasn't, EPA still hasn't issued guidance yet. So, for instance, they look at the environmental impact of aircraft de-icing fluids, and it's all, it depends on where your location is. For instance, Logan has made the case that it doesn't have enough land to do the capture. So they'd have to fill in the harbor in order to create land. So which is the worst? And they're using propylene glycol as non-toxic, but it is oxygen depleting when it gets into the water. So it is a balanced approach, but I do think in time, the EPA will designate it so that you can't discharge it even with a permit, right? So we capture it and reprocess it, but that's not the case everywhere in the country. So I just wanted to make that clear. But in time, I think it will become that. And I should have said type one is what we're making here. And in time, we hope to also have a type four, which is the final spray before the plane takes off. That's the one that shears as you, to keep that moisture off the wings as you're in takeoff.
Have you been doing this for a while, this capture? And
yeah, it's been now since 08, but we've only been manufacturing it for, what has it been now, 3 years that we've manufactured, and we still remain, again, the only airport in the country, and it's with our business partner, Inland Technologies, that can manufacture an ADF, an FAA-approved ADF from spent ADF effluent.
How did the idea come up to do this? Did somebody look at this and say, hey, we can make some money on this?
So it's still not a moneymaker in and of itself, but it makes doing right much more cost-effective. So where am I going on that? When I became airport director in 2008, and we had embarked on our large capital program with a terminal expansion. And part of the permits for our project from the main DEP was that we needed to capture our ADF. And that was one of the permitting functions of this large capital expansion program, which also included a lengthening of the north-south runway, which Micah knows well, and some other projects. So we said, yes, we can do that. We looked at best technology. So we did the capture. We were able to produce the propylene glycol, but the cost was still, the cost to do all of that processing was $1 million a year, and we couldn't offset it enough to make it continue to make it viable. And at the time, we were less than 1 million passengers a year, so that cost was $1 a passenger. By going, you know, working with Inland, you know, and I do say that necessity is the mother of innovation, you know, working with them, the recognition came that to make this really work, we had to not be selling firewood, but the finished chair. And the finished chair is FAA-approved ADF as opposed to bulk propylene glycol. So that has cut our costs in half is what ultimately happened by getting the full circle and being very innovative and efficient.
Wow. Micah, I've always thought airports were really fascinating things, but Paul makes it especially fascinating.
You're too kind, Max.
that program has got to be coming, not necessarily making money, but it's got to be close to breaking even, I would think.
It's a hard one to tell because we also get other benefits, right? Because every bit of ADF that we spray here, other than the Type 4, is made right here. So we're not trucking it. And it's always available. There were actually some smaller airports were having trouble with some shortages of ADF. You know, talk about supply chain, right? There were even issues with ADF. So... And then we also get the benefit, you know, there's a lot of benefits here. If you put all of the benefits in, it is breaking even, Micah. But overall, we're still subsidizing the capture facility. It's a little less than $500,000 a year, but that's less than half of what we're paying, you know, in 2009, right? So even with inflation, which is a big thing now, right? It's getting worse every day. it's still way better than it was.
Southern Maine is a very, very environmentally conscious area of the country. And so even when it costs us a little bit more just for the public relations alone, it's definitely worth it.
It is definitely worth it. And we're resetting the industry. And it's just nice to be at the leading edge, right? And there's more to come here. I mean, we all talk sustainable aviation fuel. That's becoming a really big issue moving forward as more and more communities and aviation is looking for what is going to be the next step. And SAF, if we can figure out the logistics around it, once it gets to the airport, it's seamless. You can mix it with Jet A. It's a pretty easy thing to work with. And our engines, it's the same. The engine doesn't know it from Jet A.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, Paul, because we are actually currently talking with somebody from the sustainable aviation fuel industry about coming and talking to us. And are you seeing demand for that at the jetport? I mean, are people talking about that? Are people asking about that or looking forward to that?
We haven't seen the pull yet. We have not seen the passengers demanding it, but we think that it's coming. It's already in Europe. I think we've all heard the aviation shaming, even though on a per passenger basis, air flight in this country, at least domestically, has the lowest. It's right there with interstate rail in terms of the miles per gallon consumed per passenger mile. Right. Or the gallons consumed per passenger mile. It's more. I mean, people think that a bus is efficient. It's nowhere near as efficient as domestic aviation. When you take a full plane with the load factors we had pre-pandemic, and even now they're nearly back again with load factors as they've pulled capacity down. that price per mile per passenger or gallons per mile per passenger, it's better than a motorcycle, right? It's better than 50 miles per gallon. And when you look at most, especially intra-city buses, they just don't have the same loads. They're just never at a 90% load factor, so they don't get anywhere near. They're down in the 20. So the same people that I'll have lamenting me at a noise advisory committee that we should be doing more for busing don't realize that the aircraft is more efficient. And that's averaged over the entire fleet. That's not just the A320neo.
Yeah.
We can cram a lot of people in an aluminum can. Leave it to commercial aviation.
Yes.
Don't get me going on that. I wrote a whole piece about it. I don't know if you saw it or not. I think I sent it to you, and we got letters.
Yeah, we did. We did. All right, Paul, before we move on, just I'll ask if there's maybe SAF is it, but are there other things in the future for the Portland Jetport that are on your mind these days?
Oh, there's, there's also the whole post-pandemic, and I won't talk your ear off, but we're all trying to figure out, you know, where the market is, when business will return. But there's also, you know, with this group, this is Airplane Geeks, right? And there's so much that's really exciting coming too. I'm sure you've already talked about vertical takeoff and landing and VTOL. So how all these are the exciting things, right? Yeah. The electrification of aviation. That's coming too, especially I think it will come on the GA side and for the shorter haul and the VTOL market. But there's just a lot of fun stuff that way and what it will mean for the final mile, right? We'll still be using the jet aircraft transcontinental, but airports can do so much more with that final mile with VTOL. And so there's a lot of interesting stuff coming down the pike, and SAF is in that mix as well.
You know, along those lines, let me just ask you one more question, if I may. Now I feel like Brian, Max. I'm sorry, but I got to ask it. In terms of that final mile, there's been talk in Portland about the transportation hub that we have, which is basically a rail and a bus station, and it's across the bay from the airport. And they keep talking about moving the transportation hub to make it more accessible. And my thoughts have always been, and I think I even wrote a letter to the editor about it, that if they move the transportation hub, really what they should do is move it to the airport. You can't move the airport, but you can set, there is a rail line that already flies, that already goes right nearby, and the buses can go there, and then you really do have a transportation hub. Has there been any discussion about that? Because that's where a real transportation hub needs to be.
I mean, I think there has been. And actually, the where it was certainly closer, but now they're looking to move it a little further away again. But I think there's other solutions. I mean, the trouble is the land constraints. It's just Portland is a we're an older city. And we're, you know, if you go to Colorado Springs, they have 20,000 acres at the airport, and we're less than 1,000. It's kind of the downside of being an airport that was, you know, built back in the, you know, back in 1935 is when it became Portland Municipal Airport. So land is tight out here. But what I think will ultimately happen is we'll have some form of rapid transit between wherever they locate it. We will have, Mike, a rapid transit connecting, and I agree, that's what you really do need to connect your nodes or get them as close as possible. So I agree 100%. Whether that initially starts as bus rapid transit and then goes to a form of light rail or something further, I see over time, but you have to connect your nodes, no question.
All right. Paul, thanks so much. Tell our listeners where they can go to learn more about the airport, the website or social media, anything like that.
Certainly. So please check out portlandjetport.org, and that can get you to all of our links. So portlandjetport.org, and you'll see about our runway project and all of the kind of interesting things. And feel free, anyone, to just come to Maine. If you don't like winter, come in the summer when it's brilliant, and grab a lobster here at the airport when you fly out.
Excellent. All right. Thanks again, Paul.
Thank you.
Can the son of the base civil engineer get a question in edgewise?
Go ahead.
No, that's okay. We covered it all.
Okay.
I figured I would give Paul the opportunity to really geek out, since I have the experience of growing up as dealing with runways and tarmac. Paul, what's the process you have to do to notify General Aviation? You've been talking about the airlines, but what's it like to put up the X's and all of the other things to prevent accidental arrivals or departures into the airspace that you wouldn't normally have to deal with? I mean, you talked about dealing with the airlines, but you've got other people flying in also.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. You are right. The X's will be out. And then we'll have two sets of X's for 29 days. Hopefully we can shrink that and it's a little less. But no, you nailed it. And we'll also, we've been working with our FBOs. So we're very blessed to have two FBOs, Northeast Air and MacJets. And they're both homegrown FBOs as well. But they have a well-known clientele, and they've been pushing the information to them. The other side is, our busiest general aviation times, when the aprons are just stuffed, right, is the summer. And the big part is to get this project, get in and get done well before when prime summer, which is we're starting to nip it a little bit in early June, but July and August, we got to be done. That's when the GA would really have a difficult time.
Yeah, you want to avoid that.
Yeah, those aprons are chock-a-block full in July and August. Thankfully. Yeah, we love that.
Yes. What's up with the geeks? David, last week we talked about something special going on at the American Helicopter Museum.
Yeah, I got permission to announce this, and there'll be links in the show notes. But I'm offering, since we're going to have a lecture series starting on March 4th with the presidency and the helicopter, it's a members-only event, but you can become a member. I've convinced my boss to change the membership specifically for Airplane Geeks listeners to 50% off the individual membership. So what's normally a year membership for $50 can be yours as an Airplane Geek or UAV Digest listener for $25. And we'll have a link to the show notes that you can sign up. And then you'll have access to the lecture series, as well as if you come to the museum, as well as discounts on any merchandise, etc. It's basically 50% off our normal individual membership.
Okay, great. That's really generous, David. That's really nice. So you'll send a link that we'll put in the show notes.
Yep, and you'll click on that, and basically we'll take you through the application process and take your payment.
And so that'll get you a one-year membership to the American Helicopter Museum, which entitles you to access to the members-only events. Benefits.
Yep, absolutely.
Great.
And you get to support the museum.
Thanks, David. We really appreciate that. And Rob, how about you? What's going on with you aviation-wise?
Oh, all kinds of fun stuff. I thought I'd mention for AOPA members that regularly read the magazine. I had a fun article come out this month in the March issue that'll be next month. Yeah, as I said, there'll be a fun article coming out in the March issue of AOPA Pilot about they've started to call me the confession pilot, because I seem to be one of the few writers they know that will actually confess to doing stupid things over the years. And so they took one of my stupid stories. But it was not completely stupid. It was just a dumb mistake. But it's kind of funny. But anyway, the other thing is that I am committed. I've got a book that some people may not know, a professional pilot career guide that was written a few years ago. Its second edition came out, I think, in 2008, and we're working on a new edition, a third edition, because there's been so much turmoil in the world of trying to become a pilot, whether you're flying for business aviation or airlines or charter or anything else. And I've got some pretty good information in there that I've gleaned from quite a few people over the last few months. And so we're going to make it quite a good guide, I think, a third edition. And so that, well, I'm not sure when that's going to be done. We're in the design stage for a new cover. And so that's taking a little longer than I thought, but it's coming. And unlike David, I'm not going to give people a discount because they listen to this show. They're going to pay full price, baby. No, I don't even know what that is yet. So it's going to be coming. But one other thing that I had, I don't know if any of you read the Wall Street Journal this past weekend mentioned that used car prices have gone through the ceiling, that some used cars are worth 40% more than they were just, 3 or 4 years ago.
Yes.
And I thought, you know what, just for the heck of it. We also, what also stimulated me is, I don't know if you guys have, do you get the Carvana ads out there by you?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Well, they're building one of those Carvana towers in the town, next town over. It's going to be 14 stories high. And so it's become quite the architectural
eyesore.
Some say eyesore. Someone says double eyesore. But the town didn't listen to anybody, so it doesn't matter. But so I got interested, and I did one of those. Tell us about your car, and we'll tell you what it's worth. And so I have my my Mini Cooper Eddie that has been with me since new. And it's a red and white one, and some of the airplane geeks and other people up at AirVenture have ridden in it. I remember a time when I put Steve Vischer in the front seat and Grant McCarron in the back seat.
That's hard to imagine. I cannot visualize that, Rob.
That was interesting.
I only got to ride in the front seat. I never got the back seat, thankfully.
So, but anyway, it's had a very long life, and it's only got 90,000 miles on it, which for a car that was built in 2006 means it's not really used that much. So I thought, I am going to try this just to see what they'd offer me for my car if I were to sell it. So I did all the calculations and added the features and all the good stuff, and I got the total, and I looked over at Nancy and I said, you will not believe what this car is worth. And she said, my God, how much? It was worth $83. So I was not only stunned, I was crushed.
$83? That's not possible.
I went into the garage and I said, Eddie, I'm not getting rid of you for $83. There's no way. I mean, the tires are worth more than that. So I was really bummed. And I think people have to take seriously take these electronic computerized car valuation systems with a double grain of salt. But my car's feelings were just really hurt this weekend. And I just wanted to share that with you all.
Sounds like it dropped a zero or two from the from the calculation or something. I don't know.
Well, I thought at least they were going to say $830, yeah, but $83.
Yeah. That's hysterical.
No, the other day I found my old Razer V3 phone that I had before I had my iPhone.
Oh,
and I
wow.
said, well, they buy these things. Let me see what I can get for it. And I went to one of those online sites, and it said, if you send us $5, we'll send you an envelope.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, Micah, you're getting ready to head off on a adventure.
It's going to be a big adventure. Our good friends, the Plain Talking UK podcast, that's Armando and Carlos and Matt and Neville, are celebrating their 400th episode on February 26th. So next, Brian, who always wants to be able to visit and is traveling like a wild man, and we'll talk about that another time, but he said, let's go visit them and take part in that 400th episode celebration. So next Wednesday, I am flying to the UK, but I'm going on a rather indirect route. I'm flying from here in Portland. I was supposed to meet Brian in Chicago, and hopefully I was going to get in the day before and finally get together with Rob, but Portland's flights, and I was going to ask Paul about this, but never got around to it. The Chicago flights on United have just been cut back, and they changed my flights no more than six times until finally I was originally going to leave at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and get into Chicago about 2 hours later and leave to London from Chicago, meet Brian, leave from London from Chicago for London at about 9 o'clock. But then they changed it. I was flying to Chicago at 7 in the morning, and I still wouldn't be leaving till 9 o'clock at night. So Brian said, don't worry, leave it to me. Let me see what I can work out for you. So I am now going to London, and before I go, I'm meeting Brian in San Francisco. So on Wednesday morning, I am flying from Portland to Newark, Newark to San Francisco, meeting Brian, getting on the plane, and going to London.
That is kind of a indirect
Newark route. To San Francisco?
Yep, absolutely. I figured I could be sitting in the Chicago United Polaris Lounge for 8 hours, or I can be flying on a 777 in business class, and I'm probably safer from COVID because of the air circulation. I'm going to wear a mask. I've got a lie-flat seat. I can take a nap. I'll be just as comfortable, if not more comfortable, and I get to fly on both a 777 and a 787.
Sounds great. There's some good logic there.
How long a trip is it on this Frisco to Heathrow?
It's about 10 hours, and it's an overnight, so I'll be able to get some sleep and get there. We arrive at 11 a.m. local, so it ought to work out just perfectly, like almost a normal day for me.
Very good.
So
very good.
Because it's all one day, and if you guys could see the look on Rob's face right now, you would all be
cracking up. His
mouth
is open.
this is adding new meeting Micah to the great circle route.
Yeah.
It certainly does.
Otherwise, we're going to start calling you Wrong Way Carrigan.
I thought about that, too. And it also adds new meaning to the term airplane geek.
Yes, it does. I like it. All right. Hey, we have an Israeli news desk report from our friend Eyal Shea. He's a former Israeli Air Force pilot. I don't think we mentioned that last time. He's also a commercial pilot now with an instrument rating. And he's also the chief ground instructor at the only flight academy in Israel. But he has a couple of items for us. The first is the Elbit UAS Hermes Starliner has received CAAI approval for operating in unsegregated civil airspace alongside manned vehicles. So, David, this is a normally military drone, basically, correct?
Yes.
And so this is, he says, probably the first such achievement worldwide. Now, the Hermes is good-sized as far as a drone is concerned. It weighs about 1.6-ton, 17-meter wingspan. This is based on the military version of the Hermes 900 in service at the IAF, as well as other air forces. He says it's capable of more than a 36-hour endurance, service ceiling of 30,000 feet with a maximum payload 450 kilograms. And, of course, it has a full sensor suite, optical, radar, EW systems as well. We'll put there's a spec sheet for the Hermes. We'll put that link in the show notes.
It's roughly equivalent to the USI Predator. It's that class. It's a medium altitude, long endurance, or a male UAS. The Israelis have been trying to sell these across the board, and making them civilian is an interesting thing. So you're talking about a fairly sizable aircraft in the civilian market, flying in civilian airspace.
Yeah, quite interesting. The next item, he said, deals with the problematic situation of implementing military systems in civil airplanes, like music, for instance. We talked about music, the system that would provide, laser-based protection to aircraft from errant drones or other objects. We talked about this in the context of FedEx saying they wanted to put this on some of their airplanes. He says legally an approval of an active defense system is not included in the CAAI or the FAA for that matter. But because such systems have been recently emerging, the Ministry of Transportation is acting on including that mission in its regulations. and they're going to bring a new rule to the Knesset, which is basically the equivalent to the House of Representatives, and that's going to happen in the coming weeks. So there's our report from Israel. You know, if we get many submissions like this, we're going to have to ask him to record them himself. This would be like history repeating itself, huh?
Over and over and over again.
Looks like we may be getting an Israeli podcast sometime soon if this goes the way all the others have.
I know. That would be great. Last week, we mentioned a poll. The question was, should the U.S. federal government create a national no-fly list for unruly passengers? And we'll give you another week, but if you want to participate in that poll, it's just a simple yes-no question. You go to airplanegeeks.com/poll690, because that's last week's episode where we introduced the poll question. Should the U.S. federal government create a national no-fly list for unruly passengers? And we have some responses so far, but I won't spoil it yet, but I will say that it's a very lopsided vote at this point.
Well, okay, but you know, we have really interactive listeners.
Yes,
but I'll
do.
Be honest, Max, we had 15 people answer this poll.
So far.
We can do so much better than that. So just take some time and go to airplanegeeks.com/690.
Poll 690.
It takes a whole 30 seconds. So because we want to hear from you, not just 15 people. I'm sure one of them was Micah. So
actually, it wasn't.
It wasn't. Not yet, anyway. All right, let's wrap this up. We want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Again, our guest for this episode was Paul Bradbury, Portland International Jetport Director. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes for every episode there. But if you want to go right to the show notes for this episode, that's airplanegeeks.com/691. Our email address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. All right, David Vanderhoof, any closing thoughts?
No, I just wish everyone a happy belated Valentine's Day, since we are recording this on Monday, February 14th. Congratulations to the Los Angeles Rams. Sorry about the Bengals. And we look forward to talking to you next week.
All right, Rob, anything from you?
No, I think I've probably spoken enough for tonight, and just say that people could find us at jetwine.com and certainly in the pages of BCNA magazine. Thank you for this interesting show, Max.
Yeah, it was fascinating. I love airports. The more I learn about airports, the more I'm fascinated by them. But so this has been a great conversation. And how about you, Micah?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at @MaineFly. That's Maine like the state, MaineFly. And for Valentine's Day, chocolate kisses to everyone.
There you go. All right. So we'll ask that you all please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night.
See you all soon.
Keep the blue side up. And thanks for listening.